Thank you. I'm happy to be here in Richmond. I was here before. I've been here a couple of times. My first book was published in 1977 and reviewed in the New York Times. I was in Utah. I'm from Utah. I'm not going to tell you this whole story except the two parts. One is that my editor called from New York and she said, "Your book has been reviewed today in the New York Times, and there's good news and bad news. What do you want to hear?" It's always been my custom to be standing at a phone booth in rural Utah, most often in the town of Dutch John, where there's a phone on a telephone pole opposite the old middle school, which is now abandoned. Stand there and listen to my editor, Carol Smith, read me the review of my book. And I said, "Give me the good news. What is it?" She read the review. It was on a Thursday. And she read a review of my first book, Betrayed by F. Scott Fitzgerald, just angelic. The editor of The Nation had written this review, and it just was perfect. I thought, he got it all. And she said, "And your picture's in the paper." I said, "How do I look?" She said, "You look good." I said, "What's the bad news?" And she said, "Well, there's no paper today. There was a blackout in New York. It was the 14th of July. There was one blackout day. So that whole review is in a collector's edition of the Times." And just tell you a little hint, I was in Utah, so I was going fishing. I was safe. You know, when I told my friends in New York that, they all fell on the floor with their hands on their hearts. But we had a book party in Washington, D.C. A friend of mine was an impresario there and had been involved in politics at a low level and hosted parties, and I met some famous people at his house, and we had this great party in the evening in the shadow of the cathedral. And there were several senators there, and my picture was in the paper the next day in July of 1977 with the ambassador to Pakistan, the only time I've ever signed a book to His Excellency. So I was feeling like a fat cat and a big shot, a young guy, wrote a book. And we came down to Richmond, one of my friends is at school here, and we were over on the avenue with the statues, and so beautiful and so strange for me, exotic, and I went out for a walk and I ended up in a thrift store and there was a copy of my book for 99 cents. It was great. So fame finds its way to Fleet, and live it up while you can. I'm going to read just two things. One is a letter and one is a story. I've been writing, honest to Pete, talk about a jaded reader. I'm a jaded writer, I think. I've written maybe 50 or 60 letters of recommendation this year. Students come to me who I've had and they say, "Would you write a letter of recommendation? I'm going to try to do the following." And it's go to a conference or get into graduate school or whatever it is. And they leave, and they leave me an envelope, and they never know what I put in these letters. Isn't that odd that they? So I thought it would be fair if I wrote, you know, I think we should sample it so students know what they're going to get. So this is the letter I wrote for Gordon Lee Bunsen. It's dated April, to Admissions Committee, from Ron Carlson, Professor of English. Recommendation for Gordon Lee Bunsen. "It is a pleasure to write on behalf of Gordon Lee Bunsen, who I have known here at Arizona State University for these past three semesters, in which he has been my student in English 5000. I also have become acquainted with Mr. Bunsen outside the classroom, and I feel I know him fairly well. As his transcript shows, Gordon Lee, who likes to be called, and will only answer to, Demon and Demon Lee, has had some problems in English 5000. But as you are well aware, a transcript only tells part of any story. Mr. Bunsen received an incomplete in his first attempt in my class, but it should be known that all 47 students in that ill-fated section received incompletes. We were unable to finish the course because of a fire in our classroom, which consumed the entire basic wing of Old Bracken Hall. In the event, I suffered smoke inhalation to the degree that I lost my voice for over a month and I could not carry on. But no one perished in the blaze, no doubt partly because of Mr. Gordon Lee Bunsen's enthusiastic screaming and crying out, 'This is some fire, and it's burning.' In the confusion and excitement of the aftermath, Gordon Lee did confess to starting the fire, stating that he wanted everyone to know what, quote, they could do with their 900 grammar rules and all the parts of speech. It is essential to note that these remarks could not be used against him in a court of law, and they shouldn't be used against him now, except as they betray a kind of native intensity, which is one of Mr. Bunsen's strongest characteristics. Now, Mr. Bunsen has transferred a great deal of his ardor toward me in the last few months, and he has completed several hundred pages, handwritten. Most of these betray a compelling and effective use of sentence fragments and phonetic spelling, which have a unique energy. This prolific outburst can be seen as encouraging. He is currently living in his car, parked just a few feet from my house, and I've been able to observe Mr. Bunsen's working habits. He's really quite remarkable, the kind of writer I would recommend to anyone. Using only the steering wheel as a desk and writing by the light of a cigarette, Mr. Lee has produced almost 30,000 words of a free-form novel which features a person with my name as a hyperbolic antagonist. What an achievement. As a kind of performance piece, he's been leaving pages of this work taped to my front door every 3 or 4 hours. Now, this is a remarkable young man. Peering out the curtains, I can see him even now, adding to his opus, working night and day, eating and sleeping, who knows when. This is an unusually well-motivated scholar. The energy and dedication here are without parallel, and his liberal use of capital letters and Scotch tape is also unique in my experience. Listen, who cares about English 5000? Subject-verb agreement in our world has long been overrated. There is a man in a car outside my house, and I'm recommending him to you with every bone in my body. Take him, please take him. If I can offer any further information, please don't hesitate to call. Call me at home. So, I wrote three of those. One is for a student who apparently has passed away a couple of semesters ago, and another is for a narcoleptic. As well as the other letters, and I send these letters out. Now, okay. This story, I'm just going to read this story then. It's called Introduction to Speech. Introduction to Speech. I've always liked visual aids. Long before I took Introduction to Speech and met Mrs. Ring, I was showing things as I talked to people. In my career as a salesman for Double American, making 6 calls a day, 5 days a week, I had been employing visual aids all these years. I never just walked in and tried to sell paper. I'm talking about going into Top Tech or Manager Plus and meeting with Sandy or Joe and showing them my new matchbooks or the nail from a flat tire or an agate I'd found. It just evolved with me. Part of it was to overcome that little thing, my shyness. But also, I like to have something I can hand to another person. I've got a shoebox with every nail from every flat tire I've ever had. It's convincing is what it is. People like to have the fact in their hand. As a visual aid in my first speech, I brought in my old metal Goodfine tackle box. I took my position behind the shaky pine lectern, weight equally distributed on both feet, and I started talking about the fishing I'd done here and there. Trips with my father to the mountains in Wyoming, fishing the lakes and rivers there. And each time I mentioned how old I had been or what river it was, I pulled a lure from the tray and I showed it. I didn't pass these things around. They had hooks. Our class was 22 people in a cramped annex classroom at Arcadia Community College. It was summer session, our slow time at Double American, which is why our boss, Tommy Candle, wanted us to take the class. At our sales breakfast, he said, "Finish the course with a beer better, and we're giving you a 1% commission raise. I know the class is going to help as we get ready for the upturn." He tapped his new copy of All-Star Sales Strategies. I read about what it can do to the personal presentation, and then he pointed at us one at a time, as if this was all just business, and he could never hurt our feelings. "Danielle, this is going to get you looking right at the customer. Sammy, this is going to help you stand still, and when you stand, stand up straight. And Andy," he said to me, "I think this will open you up, get you talking a little." He was doing everything he could to shore up the company, including adopting a highway, but I could feel that Double American paper was slipping away. It was strange for me in Introduction to Speech. I felt as if I liked giving speeches, not liked, but something. I felt different in front of the class, different than at any other time in my life. For some reason, even the 22 students didn't give me any inhibitions. "Inhibitions can hurt a speech," Mrs. Ring said. "Lack of eye contact, awkward or absent gesticulation, improper use of the hands, or nervous shifting could also hurt a speech." Mrs. Ring always stood by the door when students gave their speeches. She was a really pretty young woman who wore print dresses all summer. Sam, who was tough on women, called her chubby. So with my visual aid speech, I was uninhibited. And I went through the lures in my metal tackle box as I grew older in my story. The plastic worms, which I never even cared for, and I didn't know why I didn't just throw away, and in fact, during the speech, I did throw them away. The silver spinners, especially the luster spinners with the red gems, the plastic flatfish, yellow and green with their triple hooks, And finally, the flies. One so tiny, I knew that when I held it on my finger, that no one could see it. Then in my speech, this first speech, I went right ahead and showed what I came to show. I've always tried to say what I mean. The last part of my visual aid speech was when I told about meeting Lori and how we'd been dating and how I'd shown her, just as I'd shown the class, all my tackle, and how she'd wanted me to take her fishing. But, I said, on our way to Pinecrest, there was an accident. We were in my old Volkswagen Bug. This box was up front in the trunk. Here I stopped and I turned the tackle box around to where it's dented in. I'd never really told this story to anyone this way. I saw the tackle box in my garage when I was looking for visual aids and I thought it would make a good speech. And right now in front of everyone, I realized I'd crossed the line. I ran my finger through the dent and I felt it all again just like that. Then I heard a noise which turned out to be a little sob from Danielle, who was a good friend of mine but not one to cry. And I looked up and saw about half the class wiping their eyes and the other half staring at me without moving. And I saw Mrs. Ring by the door with both her hands flat against her cheeks. And so I just said, "The end." "Oh, for Christ's sakes," Sam said after class as we walked with Danielle to our cars in the dry, hot night. He pulls out the dead girlfriend card in the first speech, and now the hefty Mrs. Ring wants to be there for him. "That hurts, big boy. You put some of the rest of us, especially Sammy LaSalle, in the shade. What am I going to do? All of my old girlfriends, 1,000 of them," Daniel said. She was still poking at her eyes with the Kleenex. "Are still alive." He looked at me. "As far as I know." After my speech, Mrs. Ring had come over to my desk and put her hand on my shoulder and called Sammy to do his speech. He was slick. He said, "Listen, Mrs. Ring, in light of what we just heard, maybe we should just close her down for today, and I'll start off on Thursday night." In the parking lot at Danielle's Jetta, she asked us if we were coming over. She liked Sam and me to come over to her new Scottsdale condo after class and have a beer with her husband Terry and give the play-by-play. Sam took over at such meetings, and after 4 classes, he had every woman nicknamed: Wonder Bra, The Tattoo, Wifey, and of course Chubby for our dear teacher. Sam was a bright guy, but he used it like a blade. I begged off tonight because I knew I would be the only subject for discussion, and I'd had enough of that since leaving the building. I felt a little funny after giving the speech. I got to get busy tomorrow. My quota is miles and miles from here. The truth was I had 2 calls, and I knew they would both be dry. "Quotas are savage," Sam said. He pointed at Danielle. "No one will meet a quota in this world. It's not going to happen." She shrugged. "It's quiet." "It's gruesome," he said. "And boys and girls, double American will never see the coming upturn. The 1% we're getting is going to save exactly no one." "It might," Danielle said. "Terry says this is a slump." "Bless Terry and his dreamy wife," Sam said. "We've got speech class, compliments of a dumb boss, and this guy here," he jerked a thumb at me, "has just about ruined that. Poor Lori. May she rest in peace. What was that, 5 years ago? 6, I said. "Get married," Danielle said. "Marry that girl out at Buzzco." "You're seeing Maya," Sam said. I just looked at him. "Hey," he held up his hands. "I barely know her." My Friday calls were routine. Miltech was fully stocked with paper, and I knew it, but Doug was glad to see me, and we walked around a little bit checking the supply closets. Driving over to Buzzco, I was thinking about my next speech, what it would be, and if Maya was going to be working up front. Sure enough, Maya was on the counter as she was every Friday. We'd gone out to coffee the last 3 times I'd seen her. She saved her break until 11, and we'd slip away. When she saw me, she went to her desk, and I told her she wouldn't need her sweater. It was already 103. "I'm getting my purse," she said. "It's my turn to buy." Maya's 30 and a good manager. She has terrific short dark hair, which looks as if it might have been cut for efficiency, but in fact has real flair. Her face is dark, what I call a sleep deprivation tan. It was the way I looked in college. She has been through a big bad divorce last year that keeps the men away. When we went for coffee the first time, I asked her if she came along because she suspected I wasn't a threat. She doesn't smile much, but she smiled at that, I think because it was true. But she likes me, and what Maya has done at Buzzco is to continue to stock paper. Her big supply room is full, but she's also stacked under the 2 banquet tables in their conference room, solid. They've got paper until Christmas wears out. "I heard you gave a great speech," she said. "This isn't Sammy's account. He's not supposed to call you." Danielle called. She said you broke everybody's heart. Maya climbed into my Oldsmobile, a car they've stopped making. This was where, if I was any other lonely guy, and not me in my loneliness, I would have said, what do I say to break your heart? Or something flirtatious. But it has been proven to me that I am not flirtatious. I've seen Sammy say some things, funny stuff, which always gets the conversation over the empty canyon, but I can't do it. For me, it would be like reading from cards in Russian. I drove us to the pen, the grill at the edge of town, but I could tell there was something wrong with me. It was true that I was thinking about my next speech, but regardless, I could not step up. Maya said, it's Friday, and I'm tempted to have me a Corona. And she ordered that and a bowl of the tortilla chips and salsa. We'd never had the chips before. We always got coffee and one lemon Danish, and we'd had some fun some days, cutting it in half with a knife, like who's going to get the biggest piece, the most lemon, like that. So with Maya, what it all came down to was simple. I could not order the beer. What was wrong with me? I was almost unemployed, and it was Friday, and I could see the sunny desert outside the front window of the pen running from here to the horizon, and I ordered the coffee with cream the way I always have. I knew all about it. I saw her look at me, and I watched her face adjust, chin up, which was the absolute end of me. She drank about two sips of that beer total while I nursed my coffee. After the 20 minutes, she put a 10 on the table and stood up. I couldn't speak. I could barely watch. We didn't talk all the way back, and I could feel that each mile adding up, heavy and impenetrable. When she got out of the car in the Buzzco parking, her voice was different. Can you just leave one ream of red today? She asked. Big Bill's dog is lost, and he wants to put up some flyers. I retrieved the package of red paper from my trunk, and I handed it to Maya, a fact from our story, the last fact. There's a guy in the introduction to speech class who doesn't like Sammy, a military guy whose first speech was on the meaning of 50 caliber. He had a pretty good visual aid, 20 rounds of 50 caliber bullets from his work on machine guns. So he kept passing the bullets as he spoke, and he had us hold them up against our arms and our necks and hit our heads, just imagining the touch, he called it. He kept alluding to the fact that he might have a machine gun himself, but that was between him and his God, as he called it. He said if he wanted to buy a little bitty pistol, he who had served honorably in the Army would have to undergo a background check. I liked the speech, even the description of the way the bullet tumbles at 2,000 feet per second and creates such a terrible exit wound. He called that wound the price of freedom, and Sammy snorted, which he should not have done. The military guy, Captain Bell, came over to Sammy's desk and took his bullet away, saying again, the price of freedom. Danielle has real trouble making eye contact. In fact, she makes no eye contact. She looks at a place on the ceiling just over my head, or she looks at her visual aid. Her speech was called Facets of a Marriage, and she talked about the 12 sides of a good marriage, and then she held up her big fat diamond ring, finally passing it around for everyone to ooh and ah over the 12 different facets. When Danielle put it in the first girl's hand, she said, "Now I'm going to want this back." Everyone laughed. Humor, Mrs. Ring told us, when used right, is just like the proper spice. Sammy threw his old speech away and gave a new one about adopting a highway, based on our experiences with the section of roadway the Double American Paper Company had adopted. And it was a funny speech about his family history and how if there had been a thorough background check, he would have been prevented from even adopting a sidewalk or a driveway. For his visual aid, he had a baby blanket, and in it was part of old Route 123, a chunk of the nasty asphalt, which in the heat of the moment he kissed, and then he took over to Danielle for her to hold. I could see Captain Bell glowering at Sammy. He didn't like that crack about a background check. Introduction to speech has become the best thing in my little life, and I could tell by the way we three told Danielle's husband, Terry, about the class that they were enjoying it, too. Terry said, "How'd Wonderbra like that diamond?" We talked about the people and guessed at what we'd do next. Mrs. Ring had asked for a process speech, steps in a process, which could include a demonstration. Sammy said, "I hope Tattoo will show the other half of that spider that's trying to crawl out of the back of her pants." "That's a karmic circle," Danielle said. "Excellent," Sammy said. "I could use some karma." When my girlfriend Lori was killed, a whole bunch of people, mainly her family, told me to stop blaming myself, that it wasn't my fault. I guess I was acting funny, and it's tough to know what to say to someone who walks away from a wrecked car. I had a good double set of stitches into my hairline, 4 inches, and they helped. But I didn't blame myself. The thing is, I didn't know what to think, or even how to begin sorting it all out. A week went by like that, and then a month, and they took out my stitches, and then a year, and then all these years. My scars have all healed perfectly. I could show you the place, and you'd doubt me. The steps in a process speech were terrific. One of the high school girls did hers on making dreadlocks, using her friend as the model. The guy Sammy calls Mr. Wizard used his speech to explain the intermittent windshield wiper, how it worked, and he told a sad story about the inventor. It was a great speech. Tattoo didn't show us her beautiful backside, but instead explained the two-color tattoo, red and blue, and what the ink is and how it works. She showed us a book of samples with prices, which made me wonder what kind of speech this was. She closed with the fact that with her tattoos now, all 22 and a half of them, she no longer felt like just anybody. Sammy asked her what was the deal with that one half tattoo, but Mrs. Ring reminded him of the time again. Tattoo, whose real name was Darla Church, gave Sammy a saucy grin and she sat down. I will say that she's a woman that when she sits in front of you in class, it's hard not to look at the top of that weird tattoo coming out of the back of her pants. It looks to me like one of the things you find on old maps to figure out which way is north. I already knew Danielle was going to do the process of papermaking because I'd helped her carry some of her gear in. She went through the steps, shredding the fiber, the mixing, the pressing on the screen, but what was cool was she had examples of 5 kinds of paper she'd already made. This was paper she'd made from Terry's shredded underwear, which got a good laugh, and from garbage yarn from her adopted highway, and some threads from palm fronds, and some felt from an old hat, and a huge sheet of paper made with only eggshells. It was a good topic for Danielle because she had to keep moving and showing stuff, and so her eye contact problem wasn't so prominent. I could see how Danielle's speech, if you weren't up to your eyeballs in paper already, might make you want to go home and make some. Sammy's process was the true story on picking up women, which he said was part of an old and respected science, which included such illustrious investigators as Benjamin Franklin, who wrote an 8-point treatise on how to choose a mistress. I could see his opening struck a note of fear in Mrs. Ring, whom I knew I now had a crush on. The way you know you have a crush on someone is that you know without looking where they are in the room. I did not want my slippery friend Sammy to say anything coarse in her presence. That's another way you know. But Sammy walked the line. He went for the humor in making it all sound scientific, and most of the class, but not all, thought he was funny. He closed with the fact that his methods always worked 100% of the time, but that he wasn't as sure of what to do with women once he picked them up. In fact, he admitted, he was relatively terrible in the keep women department, and that would be his next speech. When Mrs. Ring called on me this time, I felt that strange feeling which has a little of fear in it, but it was a feeling I was honest to God starting to like. I went to the front of the room and I started in by taking out a box of kitchen matches and holding one up. I'm hooked, as I said, on visual aids. And I knew for a fact that if I held up a match, I'd have every eye, and I did. I then launched in to the history of the match. I got the idea one night when I was looking at the cases of my matchbook collection. What's the deal on matches? Where did they come from? 5 hours later, as the library was closing, I had traced the development of the match, and there is some weird stuff in there. For a long time, if a guy wanted a light, he had to carry 2 ingredients and mix them together. And later, there was a deal called the Lucifer, which is a slim glass tube. You broke it, and the wick inside burst into flame so you could light your stogie. You had to be careful not to sit on the thing. Anyway, my speech brought us all the way back to the safety match, which I then lit, and my classmates applauded, and I caught Mrs. Ring smiling at me. The class was 90 minutes, and we had time for one more. So this is when Captain Bell went up to the front. He moved our shaky wooden podium to one side and started pacing back and forth, talking about self-defense. Personal safety, he told us, is a matter of personal responsibility. We can't always be calling the cops. And criminals are everywhere. Assailants are everywhere. Assailants, many times, are in surprising and unexpected places, like outside the dry cleaners or the pizza place. There's a crime committed every second or something. Every 2 seconds, frequently. We need to learn to protect and defend ourselves. Then he said he needed a volunteer. Sammy was on the other side of Danielle, or else I would have stopped him. Sammy stood up and went forward. "You don't have that machine gun on you, do you?" he asked Captain Bell. The captain did not smile. He handed Sammy a wooden ruler. "This is a butcher knife," he told us. "The assailant has a butcher knife and confronts you head on." Sammy faced the captain, holding the ruler as a knife. "Now," the captain said, "approach me." Sammy stepped toward the captain. We were all looking at the ruler when Captain Bell grabbed Sammy's other hand and pulled him around in a bear hug and a chokehold. With Sammy almost aloft like that, the captain continued explaining and pointing out the attack points, the eyes, the neck, the gut, the groin. Sammy turned red but smiled, and the captain put him down. "It doesn't take great strength," Captain Bell said, "but you have to be alert, and when you act, you have to be fully committed." He turned his back on Sammy, saying, "Now, attack me from the rear." The captain talked all through what happened next. Sammy looked stupid, tiptoeing up with the ruler like a stupid assassin, and he was mugging for the class, especially Tattoo, Darla Church, when Captain Bell grabbed him. He seized his left wrist and slapped the ruler clear to the back wall with his other hand. Then came a moment in introduction to speech which I will never forget. Captain Bell was still talking, saying, "When this sleazebag thinks he has the upper hand with his big knife, you jolt the forearm and get rid of the weapon. Keep track of where it goes. You might need it later. Then an arm twist just so, and if he resists further..." Sammy had ceased resisting. He was a comical rag doll who was suddenly upside down at his full length, his two legs like crazy hands on a bad clock, wheeling toward the ceiling. It was some kind of full flip. People gasped, and we all reflexively slid back. Sammy continued in his fabulous arc, past noon, one, two, suddenly parallel to the floor, his one shoe striking the wooden chalk tray under the blackboard like a hammer, splintering it and sending chalk dust through the room. The same second, his body slammed the floor, and I heard Sammy say a little, "Oh." Mrs. Ring quickly ran to the front of the room and knelt by Sammy, and I joined her alongside of Tattoo and a couple other students. Mrs. Ring's light blue dress, printed with black diamonds, fell open as she bent to Sammy, and I looked deeply into those shadows, her gleaming breasts, the tiny clasp on her bra in front. Captain Bell was still closing his speech, walking around at us, explaining that even with your assailant on the ground, he was still a danger. He was talking like he wanted to further his assault, and I worried he might mistake me for an assailant. Sammy hadn't passed out, but he was gray. He was looking at me, and he started to speak when he simply turned his head and vomited into Mrs. Ring's lap. The next week, I started skipping calls. It was too hard to go into these companies and have folks I'd known for years feel bad about not needing any paper. We'd used up all the small talk. I'd shown them all my visual aids, matchbooks, etc. I did have the story about Sammy in speech class, but I didn't want to tell that right away because it wasn't exactly over. Sammy was bent on revenge. Not bent, but ready for revenge. And not ready, but raging, an inferno, to hurt Captain Bell. I didn't exactly know what to do with myself. I wasn't going to work. I put on my answering machine and looked around my little house. We had one speech left, a speech to convince. And there wasn't a convincing thing in my place. I went to the library because it had helped me with that last speech. Inside, the old folks were reading all their hometown papers. They were pretty convincing. It was quiet in there, and I had written a fair speech on matches at that one table, but I couldn't get an idea in my head. I could make no breakthrough, but I came to understand something new about introduction to speech class. I wanted to write a speech to convince, which would convince Mrs. Ring that I was interesting. In fact, I understood I was only speaking to her. I'd had her on my mind every day, I guess, and looking back, I could see it. This feeling generally confused me. She was my teacher, and I'd seen her full breasts and her fragile underwear, but it was more than that. When she stood in the doorway in her dresses, I wanted to say something in my speeches which would make her admire me. I didn't want to pass with a B or better. I wanted Mrs. Ring. Sammy's speech was the most amazing speech I've ever heard in person. He wore a tie and stood squarely behind the podium. He started with personal evidence. "Most of you in this room, where we have shared so many ideas, had the chance to see me last week as I performed a role in Captain Bell's speech on self-defense." Here he nodded at the captain and went on. Most of you saw me rise into the air about here, he pointed up, and continue around until I came back to Earth about there. He pointed down this time. Listen, it was a long trip, and I had a lot of time to think while I was in the air. Sammy's eye contact was strong, and he stayed squarely balanced on both feet, not shifting nervously. He was headed for some big points. My first thought was, why does Captain Bell want to hurt me? And there are many legitimate answers to that question. Most of them are something like, because I'm a smartass. I've been hurt for it before, but that doesn't make it right. But what Sammy went on to say was about forgiveness. He said he'd met someone, talked to her, laid out his anger, and she had met his anger with calmness, and she had talked him down from the mountain of anger, and that was his phrase, mountain, and that he was convinced that forgiveness was more powerful than revenge. And if we weren't convinced of this, we should watch his visual aid. With that, he moved from behind the lectern and stepped over to Darla Church. She stood up and wrapped in her luxurious tattoos, and they kissed. I hope that if kissing in the old annex is against school rules, you'll forgive me for it, Sammy said. And now to close my speech, I'm going to grab Captain Bell by the hand that threw me for a loop. He went over and shook Captain Bell's hand and said, no hard feelings. That's my whole speech. There was quite a bit of applause in the classroom. Sammy had become a successful speech giver, and I was happy for him. After class, he had another surprise for me. He and Darla were waiting by my Oldsmobile. Did Tommy Candle tell you what I'm doing? No, I said, but I'm thinking of letting it go. Quit? You can't quit. You are Mr. Double American. You're good at it. Besides, I already quit. I looked at him and he went on. I did. He's going to give my accounts to you and Danielle. Come on. No, I did. We're going way over to Silver City. Darla, already around Sammy's arm, kissed his neck. Your brother's barbershop? That's what it is. I've already got my license. Now he shook my hand. I started my last speech this way. I'm about to give you each a feeling, and I want you to remember this feeling as I talk about writing a letter, because it is this feeling that will ultimately convince you to write a letter, not me or any of my remarks or visual aids, but this feeling, the feeling I'm about to give you. So remember the feeling. Now, here it comes. Get ready for your feeling. I was having a little fun with my speech, but at the same time, I was gesturing accurately and not too much, and I made eye contact by moving my head slowly from left to right and back again. I was gripping the edge of the flimsy lectern, but not too tight. I've written you each a personal letter. I know a little, and sometimes a lot, it seems, about you from all our speeches. And I've written a letter to you and only to you. And I've written a letter on paper with this pen. I held my old ballpoint pen aloft, my visual aid, and I sealed each letter in a paper envelope. So here's your letter. Then I passed out the letters to my classmates, and the one envelope with Mrs. Ring's name on it, I handed it to her. It was a simple speech about how nice it is to receive a letter. I worked hard on it, each of the letters, but I don't know if I convinced anybody or not. I closed it down with my last visual aid, a silver letter opener, which I held up and then I passed around. Parking at my condo was always a rocky amenity. The lot itself was cratered throughout with potholes, and the metal roofing was heavily damaged. About once a month, somebody backs a U-Haul into it and crimps the edge back for a foot or two. Stars poke through the tears in the metal sheets. Tonight, when I came home from calls in which I moved a couple dozen reams of paper, my order book is starting to come to life, I saw a white Saturn in my place under the terrible parking roof. There was somebody in the vehicle. It was Mrs. Ring. To see her away from the old campus this way, especially at my place under the ruined roof, parked in the oily gravel, stunned me. My heart began gesticulating wildly, but I approached and tapped on her window. I could see her letter from my speech on the dashboard. Mrs. Ring opened her door and stood out in the night. She said to me, if it wouldn't be too strange for you, there was a silence as big as they get. A gray thing I'd fallen into 100 times before. If you could, I heard myself speak. You want me to take you fishing, Mrs. Ring? I maintained eye contact. I've never been, she said, and there was a lake in your letter. She faltered and grabbed my arm, a touch. I shouldn't be here. No one should be here, I told her. My inhibitions were all gone. I stepped toward her in the dark place between the cars, and I put my fingertips on the hip of her dress. I wrote you a letter. I know you did, she said. I appreciate it. I could smell her powder, sweet and ready. She was as far over the line as I was. We could certainly do that, Mrs. Ring, I told her. We could go out to Big Lake. Hearing myself speak those words, I knew right where my maps were, something I would show her next. Thank you.